Auf Spurensuche nach Natürlichkeit. Beiträge rund um die innere und äußere Natur von Bastian Barucker.
Herzlich willkommen, Isabelle Monsui. Vielen Dank, dass Sie sich Zeit für ein Gespräch nehmen. Ich stelle Sie kurz vor, Sie sind Professorin für Neuroepigenetik an der Universität Zürich und der Eidgenössischen Technischen Hochschule, Co-Direktorin des Hirnforschungsinstituts der Universität Zürich und stellvertretende Leiterin des Instituts für Neurowissenschaften an der ETH. Ich habe gerade im Vorgespräch erfahren, dass Sie seit 20 Jahren in der Epigenetik forschen und werde jetzt die Sprache wechseln, weil ich mit Ihnen auf Englisch kommuniziere, weil wir gerade festgestellt haben, dass ein besseres Gespräch zustande kommt, wenn wir Englisch sprechen, weil in der Fachwelt und Sie, wenn Sie in der Fachwelt kommunizieren Sie Englisch über dieses Thema. As I said before, today the topic will be epigenetic. And most people have not heard about epigenetics probably that much, but I would assume that most people are affected by epigenetics or what you are researching on. So this is why also I decided to have this conversation with you, because I think it's actually relevant for the society. And I wanted to start by asking you to tell us and the audience in a nutshell, what is epigenetics and what are you researching in terms of epigenetic?
Epigenetics is really a part of our body. It's like the hard drive of a computer and the software. So the hard drive of a computer is the DNA code, the genome, and the softwares are the epigenome. So one cannot function without the others. So whatever we do, wherever in our body, every single cell contains a genome, the genetic code, and epigenetic factors. So it's not like suddenly we discovered epigenetics and they play a role sometimes and not others. Epigenetic factors, they are always active in our body, even from the very, very beginning in the initial cell. In reproductive cells, there is a genome and an epigenome. So it's really part of the biology of cells and organisms. So as a biologist or molecular biologist like I am, it's absolutely essential to study both the genome, the genetic code, and the epigenome. And it's even more important for the epigenome because the epigenome is dynamic. It responds to the environment, depending on our experiences, what we eat, the compounds we are exposed to, our social life, whether we practice sport and so on. This modifies the epigenome. So it's only by studying the epigenome that we can really understand how life experiences, environmental factors modify us.
So epigenetics is basically looking just at genetics is missing a big part, and epigenetics is making the picture a wholesome picture, kind of?
That's exactly this. It's like if you would look only at the hard drive of a computer and you don't consider softwares, you have only a part of it. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the problems of the domination of genetics, is that for many, many years, people thought that by understanding the genome, being able to read the sequence, to know the sequence of the DNA, we'll understand everything. But that's not the case at all. We need to understand all the epigenetic factors.
And I think I remember that there was a big hype about a genome project, I think it was called, where it was about like knowing every DNA part, and it was... The discussion was kind of like, if we have figured this out, then we know everything about the human being. But it doesn't seem to be the case.
Not at all. That was a hope, maybe a hype even. People should have realized quite quickly that even if you know the sequence of the DNA, which is not that simple, actually, there are still parts of the DNA which we know the sequence, but we don't understand what they do. What it does, but that's why epigenetic factors and mechanisms, it's absolutely essential to understand them. Mm.
So since you've been in this field for 20 years, I would assume that it motivates you or that you keep on researching because there are certain factors that you think are really relevant. What are the things in your field of research that most important or where you feel most motivated about or where you feel most important that these topics are most important for people to know?
I'm myself very motivated by epigenetic inheritance. So the fact that germ cells, so sperm cells and all the cells before, and oocytes, so male and female germ cells, those which fuse to create the offspring, that these cells, they carry an epigenome which has with it information about past experiences, whether positive or negative. And that, indeed, us, we are a combination of information which is contained in the genetic code of our parents, each parent, but also in the epigenetic code, in the epigenome of each of the parents. And that's extremely important to be able to understand heredity, to have the full picture of heredity and understand how exposures, environmental factors or life experiences in our parents and perhaps even our grandparents can influence us. And this is a field of research which was not existing 20 years ago. It's only quite recently that the field of epigenetic inheritance is really considered a discipline on its own. And conceptually, it's also something which needed to accumulate evidence to convince people that indeed it's not only genetics which counts, but the epigenetics is also very important to determine who we are and how we function.
Mm. So I've read your book and I also read some publications, and I wanted to know about you because in German, the book title is kind of called How We Can Direct Our Genes, I would call it. So what I would like to know is, how does it actually work? You just talked about it, that experiences we make or even our parents made or their parents made, that they get into the cell, or that they, I mean, how is it registered in our body, in our cells, these experiences? How does this work? Is there an easy way for me or for you to explain it so I could understand it?
Yeah, the title is admittedly a bit overstated. Mm. That was the choice of the publisher.
As always.
Yes, because we cannot modify the genes themselves. But again, like the hard drive of a computer, this is a code. And this code, we need to read it and we can use it different ways. You know, the genome is a very, very long piece of code, and you can read some parts at a single moment for a certain time in certain cells. And that's what is required. That's what the epigenetic factors do. We start off with everyone after fecundation. It's one cell. And this cell has one genome. And you imagine that after development, we have brain cells, we have skin cells, we have liver cells. And these cells, they all contain the same DNA. Mm. It's like they all have the same hardware, but they are very different cells. Very different functions, some very different shape. And this is because the code is read differently in these different cells. So that's what the epigenome or epigenetic factors are needed for, to read the code, to read the right part of the code at the right moment to create different cell types. And once the cell types are created and we have a body, then the epigenome, epigenetic factors are continue to be necessary to regulate and to make each cell function.
Mm.
And because epigenetic factors, they are influenced by nutrients, by factors in blood. Let's say we have the brain. The brain is fed, is nourished by cells within the brain, but also by blood. And if there are components from our diet or from the environment in the blood, which penetrate brain cells and act on the genome, on the epigenome, then this can induce changes in the way neuronal cells or other cells will function. So that's really the link in between the genetic code, so the hard drive of the computer mm-hmm. and the environment. The link is the epigenetic factors.
Mm-hmm. So you already said the fact is that there are, you also just talked about nutrition, it's also in your book. I really would like to focus on something that I have been researching about and reading about for the last 11 years, which is the experiences people make as a child or in their childhood, very early on, and how they affect behavior, the body, the biology maybe even of a person. And in one subchapter of your book, it's about the consequences of childhood trauma. And we also talked about it, that the word, we can talk about the word trauma, because most people will now say, oh, I didn't have trauma, so it's not about me, but this might not be true, we will see. And but you basically say that the experiences we make in the first weeks and months of our lives have a strong or big effect on our lives, or can have, let's say can have. How would you describe it? How do these early experiences influence the person, the body, the brain, the cells? And then how do they affect us even in adult life without us maybe knowing about mm-hmm. it?
It's a very complex process. And in human, it's important, in human and animals, but it's important to distinguish the biology, so what is in the cells, from the environment, the culture, the social interactions, the education, the family habits. Let's say if you have a family who is very caring, loving, where there is a strong attachment, as opposed to a family with violence, neglect, abuse, the conditions are very different, and then it's difficult to distinguish an event if, let's say, there was a trauma in childhood, but then the environment is different. It's both factors, the prior experience and the current environment, which influence who we become when we are adult. So in humans, it's impossible, basically, to distinguish that. The real biology, whether the early trauma left something in cells, which is embedded into the cells and make the body respond differently when we are adult, plus all the common, the regular daily environment which influence us. Mm-hmm. That's why we are experimentalists. We work with mice, because with mice in the lab, we can distinguish all that. We can separate the biology from the environment, because we have a very good control over the life or the experience of animals. Let's say we want to test whether traumatic experiences modify the biology in the cells. We apply a trauma to these animals, and then we control what they live, and we make sure that it's the only trauma. They don't live anything else across their adult life, and that each animal experiences exactly the same. Same food, same environment, same cage, same social group. And then we can look at what makes a difference between these animals which were exposed to the traumatic experience and those which were not. Mm. And then we can look at what happens in cells. And that's where we were able to see that indeed this early experience has modified the biology of cells. Again, not the genetic code, because being exposed to trauma is not going to induce point mutations or to change the genome, unlike X-rays or UVs or carcinogens. But these experiences have changed the epigenome quite dramatically. And some of the epigenetic changes, they stay. They may not stay exactly the same throughout life. They may also evolve. But there are epigenetic changes which are still present in the adult. So it's how we distinguish, we observe, we can conclude that indeed epigenetic factors are modified by early life experiences in the body, in organs, and also in germ cells, and that some of these changes persist until adulthood and may be responsible for alterations in behavior, for disease, and also for the transmission of these symptoms to the offspring.
Hmm. So I just said it, that it's when people hear the word trauma, they most likely think of a war or of some catastrophe that was happening that is way outside of what they have experienced. But we talked about it before, and this might be also a factor in your research, because you just said the sentence, we applied trauma to these mice now. So let's maybe talk about trauma, or what are the things that practically can affect that people, or it's, you are researching with mice, so that there are these changes you talked about. Does trauma only mean a war, or can trauma also mean something different for a young human being that they experience?
No, psychiatrists and psychologists would say that a trauma is an experience, whether a physical experience, an emotional experience, a verbal experience. It doesn't have necessarily to be on the body. It may be, you know, a verbal violence, any kind of extreme experience which is adverse, which is violent, and which perturbs your body and your mental balance. So in daily life, I mean, trauma can be of multiple nature.
Mm.
It can be violence in the family, it can be abuse, it can be neglect. A combination of all of that, and abuse, that can be physical abuse, sexual abuse. It's very often people who are exposed to trauma, it's a multi-factor conditions or experiences which put the individual at stress, which induce lots of stress, insecurity, and when it happens in children, it can be very detrimental, because it prevents them from building a self-esteem, from developing normally, and having confidence in adults, in the world, and being normal, psychologically balanced people.
Mm.
So that's why I think trauma is really embedded in our, very deep in our society, and affects many people, many more than what we think.
Are there any numbers about this? But it's hard to measure, I guess, to know how many percentage of a population have experienced experiences like this. Is there any research as to know how many, how much of a percentage?
I mean, there are some percent which can go from 10 to 50%. It really depends where you do the investigation. If you go to a country with conflict, you now go to Israel or Gaza, 100% of the people would have experienced trauma. If you go to, I mean, Germany or Switzerland, lower percent, but that may still be 20, 30, 40%, particularly in children who would have been abused or who would have been exposed to family violence. But it could also be, you know, a car accident, the death of a parent, the death of a friend, or something in life which is destabilizing and inducing stress. And, you know, each individual has its own response to that. People may be affected for a couple of days and then they will recover. Mm-hmm. Some people may be resilient. They say, yes, that's bad. I'm affected today, but let's be positive and continue. Even some children have this capacity. So then, you know, the consequence on the body really depends on that, on the person itself, but also on the environment. You know, if there is a very bad thing happens in a family, but the family is very supportive, there are discussions, there is love, there is care, the trauma will be affecting the individual much less than if someone is abused and is left alone and there is additional violence in the family. That will certainly have a greater impact on the person for a longer time.
Mm. So before I would like to talk to you about mothering, because there is a part in the book is about motherly care, I would translate it. But I just experienced something just some days ago that I wanted to tell you and I ask you, because there was a woman who had worked in a therapeutic environment because she wanted to know more about herself. And she realized that when she was very young, even before birth, her surrounding really wanted her to be a boy, because there were already a lot of young girls in the family, and especially the father wanted a boy. And in her work that she did, I cannot prove it, you know, but she said that she found out that she already recognized before being like born that her surrounding had this expectation from her to be a boy, and that she was kind of afraid to come into the world because she knew she is not a boy, and she was afraid how people would react if she would see that. So from her perspective, she said she already then learned to try to fulfill the expectations of other people, to be like they want her to be. And now she is she was 50 years old, I think. She now started to realize, this is, maybe there is a connection between her adult life and this pre-birth life. And I wanted to ask you, does this sound, from an epigenetic point of view, does this sound like something like you would say, this can be real? Because I know a lot of people that would say this is absurd. There can't be a connection between these experience pre-birth and a 50-year-old woman who has difficulties in not fulfilling people's expectations, but knowing what she wants. Do you think this is an absurd connection, or is it a connection that could be epigenetically explained?
There is certainly a connection between the conditions during in prenatal life and what a human being becomes when adult. But it's probably not the baby herself who realizes, yes, my parents in the womb, my parents want a boy, I'm a girl, so there is a problem. That's the interpretation of this lady a posteriori. If her parents or no one in the family would have told her that indeed they wanted a boy, she would have never known it, and the matter would be very different. So I think it's a consequence of the social environment, of the culture, of exchange, of discussions about that matter or that issue for her. However, the mother, while she was expecting this hopefully boy, she may have been a little anxious. She may, you know, have been stressed because she was hoping to have a boy, not knowing whether it would be a boy or a girl. So you can imagine that a mother, an expecting mother with this fear of maybe carrying another girl as opposed to a boy, this could have consequences on the baby, but unrelated to the matter itself, to the subject itself. The stress of the mother could be due to something else, but it's just the physiological state of the mother with some anxiety, some fear due to that. This may have had consequences on the baby. At the same time, you know, when you expect, I mean, there are, during these 9 months, there are always periods of anxiety, fear, stress for whatever reason, at work or in the family or if you are sick. And each baby has experienced maternal stress at some point or another. This does not mean that it's going to make that baby sick later on. I mean, there is what we call homeostasis. So the system can absorb some level of stress. I don't know if this person lives better by knowing that, well, that's something that was from the very beginning. Perhaps it makes the matter worse. But I think it's more a personal or human interpretation of biological fact, perhaps.
So that you just talked about it, about the mother and maternal stress, and there's a part of the book that is about motherly care or mothering, I would say, and it's about the importance or the significance of motherly care. Can you explain what is meant by that, and what happens if it's not sufficient of it, or if the motherly care is not enough, maybe.
Mm-hmm. It's care not necessarily by the mother, by the biological mother herself. Mm-hmm. It's just when a baby is born, the baby needs care. To be fed, to be loved, to get affection, to have some attachment, whoever this is. This is very important for the development of, there are most species have that, the parental or attachment very early on, because it's necessary for the body, for the physiology, but also for the mental or brain health. In mice, it's very pronounced because female mice, they raise, I'm talking about mice because it's a lab animal, sure, that we use for research. But mice have these particularities that it's only the mother who takes care of raising the pups. The father does not intervene. So mice have a very strong maternal care, and they spend literally all their time, 100% of their time, by their pups, taking care of them, nursing them, licking them, grooming them. In humans, it's very different. Mm-hmm. A baby can be taken care of by another woman, actually. Many families, rich families in the past, there was a nurse who was taking care of children, and the mother just had very little control or role into that. But it's necessary for the proper development of many species.
Mm. And what happens if this care by the parents is not, it's hard to say enough, but what if there's a lack of care? I mean, I have read some of the experiments, or I know from the literature that, like in mice, for example, if they don't get licked or if they get neglected for a long time, then they really change behavior, right?
In mice and rats, it was shown that poor care can lead to increased anxiety, increased depression, and various types of behavior problems with social behaviors. Mm. In humans, of course, if a child is not taken care of properly, this will also make him or her difficult to have self-esteem, to properly develop, and to exchange, child needs to, that we watch him or her, that he needs to be taught, even if the child does not understand the language, but, talking to a baby is very important, exchanging, communicating, communication is something which is essential for in many, many species. Birds, they communicate, and any animal does that. Penguins also communicate, even if there are hundreds of penguins on the in an area. So it's the basics of balance,
mental balance.
Mm. So if these mice, for example, if they experience neglect, and then they become mothers themselves, do they then replicate the behavior that they have experienced, like? Maybe they have been neglected in some way, then they themselves are mothers. Do they neglect, or do they have a different social interaction with their pups? Then how does this work?
Yeah, this has been demonstrated in rats, mostly by Michael Minet, researcher at McGill University in Montreal, in Canada, where they selected female rats who were bad mothers, in a way, and female rats who were good mothers, based on the amount of maternal care they were giving, the quality of maternal care, and indeed the bad mothers, because they don't take care properly of their pups, the females in the litter, rats have very large litters where there may be five females, five males. Mm. So these females, they become themselves bad mothers because they were not raised properly. So there is a perpetuation of these traits, these symptoms, these features by care itself. It's epigenetic, but it's not epigenetic inheritance. Mm. Because if you take these females, which were born from a bad mother, and you have them being raised by a good mother, they will become themselves good mother. So this can be reversed. It's fully determined by maternal care. If the care is good, the animals will be good mothers. If the care is bad, they will be bad mothers, because with growing in a with bad care, it cannot really make you a normal animal, normal rat.
But that I found it very interesting, and I read about it and I thought, wow, this is amazing, because somebody has experienced something, a lack of something. I mean, that these mothers, these mice mothers can develop a very pro-social or mothering behavior because they get it themselves. Mm-hmm. I found it amazing.
Yeah, this can be explained by the fact that if you are not well taken care of when you are young, then you will become anxious, fearful, depressed. So overall, the behavior is perturbed. So then how can you take good care of your pups if you have all these symptoms?
Yeah, but probably there is no, I imagine it's hard to do, to research if that is the same for humans?
Probably, yeah, I mean, there is lots of research on the consequences of bad parenting or neglect in childhood, and this is very often associated with psychiatric disorders in adult life.
Okay.
But again, in human, it's always difficult to distinguish each factor. You know, a family where parenting will be poor, where there is violence, it's very complicated, because often there are many, many factors and you cannot distinguish each factor.
It's not a lab.
Exactly. In mice or rat, you know exactly what to do. The time, and you control every factor.
Yeah. I wanted to talk about one thing that's in the book, that it's also, I mean, it's in different parts, and it's about trends, like how experiences are passed on through generations. And if there's another German book that it's called Health is Not by Coincidence, mm-hmm. and it's about epigenetics. And then there's, I can't paraphrase it perfectly, but it says, every experience we make, our parents make, and their ancestors made, can somewhere be found in ourselves or saved in ourselves, you know, roughly. And in this book, it's mostly about stress, about how we deal with stressful situations. And you claim in the book that our approach or our reaction to a stressful situation is affected about how or what our ancestors have experienced, or for example my grandma or my grandfather. Can you explain that?
Mm-hmm. I think you were referring to the book of Peter Spork, probably.
Yes, exactly.
Yes, it's not like every experience from the past mm-hmm. can be passed or can leave traces that will determine or influence what you are. There are some traces, some effects which will remain, but not all of them. And we don't know exactly what is the level, the threshold of stress or of endocrine disruptor exposure or of poor diet. Where is the bar, the limit above which this will leave changes, make changes which are going to be permanent? It's assumed, well, based on some research, that if it's a mild stress, the mild stress may have some effect, but that most of the effect will go away after a couple of days or months. But if it's a chronic stress, which happens early in life, during a critical period when cells are vulnerable, some of these changes may stay. We don't know exactly at the molecular level what are these changes. We know that it's not a change in the genetic code, but we know that some epigenetic factors are changed. Epigenetic factors, like there are methyl residues or modifications of the DNA itself or RNA, which are molecules around the DNA. And we know, for instance, that in germ cells, in sperm cells and the precursors, that RNA can be modified by stress and that some of these modifications, they persist throughout life until conception. So that could be, you know, a remnant, a trace, a modification, a molecular modification, which carries messages from the stress, from the trauma. But it could be, it's the same for endocrine disruptors, bad diet or cigarettes, smoke, alcohol, cocaine. And that these changes, they can explain why there are symptoms which affect the offspring.
Because I just used this example because in my perception, and I also read research for this topic, is that stress is an experience that more and more people have. Like there was a survey here in Germany about adolescent, and a high percentage of them, and this was from 9 to 12 years or 14 years old, a high percentage of them says that they regularly feel stressed. And this is where I got like, ooh, this is not good. It's not good if people regularly, young people feel stressed. This is why I wanted to ask you about the stress, because it seems like it's not very healthy to experience stress a lot, isn't it?
A lot, no. A little bit, yes. It's hard to tell, actually. If, let's say, you compare these young people with young people in 1920, 1930, what do they really mean by stress? One of the problems, I think, is that we talk a lot about stress. We hear about stress everywhere on social media. It's like, you know, a kind of a perception or statement that our societies are very stressed, that we live in very unstable times, that there is a lot of violence, insecurity. I'm not sure, actually. That may simply be, in part, perception. If you compare with some periods in history, we are very peaceful. Most of the teenagers or young people you are talking about, I mean, they have a fantastic life, right? They have enough to eat, they have a place to live, they go to school, they have friends, they have everything they need. They go on holidays and so on. What is really the source or cause of stress? So there is a lot of it's a creation or mental and societal construction to some part. Doesn't mean that the young people don't feel stress. Maybe if you hear all the time that there is stress, yes, of course, that can have a consequence. But I tend to say that, and people should perhaps just pause and say, what are we talking about exactly here? Is it really that our life is so stressful? None of these teenagers, their life is threatened, right? Unlike in other countries or other times in history.
So you just said that let's compare, if you compare the lives from these teenagers to like 100 years ago, it's a different world. And I researched a little bit more about this, about the passing on of experiences through generations, and actually found something that our own government, it has a scientific, let's say board, but it you can, like, people in the government, they can ask this scientific institute, yeah, and say, what's the status to this? What do we know about this? It's called Wissenschaftlicher Dienst, for the German listeners, they will know. And in 2016, somebody asked them about the passing on of experiences through generations. It's really interesting. I read it. And then, because I wanted to ask you about it, there's one passage about the Holocaust and how these experiences may still affect our own society, people living now. And it says that there is like higher prevalence, or more people can have maybe psychological problems, as you already said, because of trauma that their ancestors experienced. It's basically the same that you just said. And but it also said it's not necessarily. It's like, because you have experienced this, this will happen. This connection can be made, they say. But what they conclude is that because of the experiences maybe the grandparents had, zu Holocaust oder Third World War, there might be more fearful, like in general more fearful. So I wanted to ask you, and I think it's also part in the book, and I know you can't, one cannot say general something about it, but to what degree does in this special case, the Holocaust and the Third World War still have an effect on society here in Germany, but also in other countries, of course? Is it somehow possible to describe if there is an effect and what it could be?
It's hard to tell because there is certainly an effect, but it depends on multiple factors. Culture, education, tradition, and also whether there are any celebrations or what is in your daily life which make you remember the Holocaust. And perhaps, of course, all of Europe was affected by Holocaust. But maybe in Germany, there is also the notion of a failure that you won't have in France, for instance. So this, it's the perception of war today, what the ancestors did, they failed, and this has led to, you know, very important major events in German history. It's hard to tell whether this is associated with epigenetic changes. Mm. And there is a researcher in the US, Rahel Yehuda, who has worked for many years on Holocaust survivors in the US and their children and grandchildren, with lots of psychometrics where she interviewed people and asked them about their stress and fear. And they did also some epigenetic analysis. It's hard to draw firm conclusions, but obviously people who survived Holocaust, who flew to the US, they may not be the most affected because they were safe, but that leaves traces, remnants, and possibilities of trauma in the family, because it completely made the life of these people upside down. Every major historical event everywhere in the world can leave traces in the people for centuries, for over generations. Again, it all depends on how much we talk about it, right? There are countries who are able just to forget, we move on, we don't talk about it, we don't commemorate, we don't teach it at school, we just try to forget it. But in Europe, there is a tradition. I don't know about Germany, how this is taught at school. I know in France that, the Holocaust is something that people talk about in historical classes and that young people know about.
Mm. So you just referenced it, I think, a while ago where you said, yeah, there's war going on everywhere and how much stress do we really have? If you see wars, I mean, it's not a biological question, or it's not maybe your research field, but I would assume that knowing all this about epigenetics, it changes also the way if you see war going on or trauma being inflicted, because at least from my understanding, I would know, man, this is going to affect much more people than the already horrible suffering that is happening there, because it seems like these experiences then get passed on to generations, to other people.
Yeah, it probably has always been the case.
Yeah.
Whether there are more conflicts today than two centuries ago or during Middle Age, I don't know. I'm not sure. Proportionally to the population, I would say that even today there are better structures to treat people. I'm not saying that people don't suffer as much as before. Of course, I mean it's a disaster for some countries or some regions of countries. From an epigenetic perspective, or from a, you know, how the world and the environment influences you. I would say it's one of the factors, you know, conflicts, trauma, stress. But there are many other factors which are as important in terms of influencing our physical health and mental health. Mm. And this is endocrine disruptors, for instance, pesticides, which are everywhere, everywhere in the world, because they have been used massively in some countries, are still used for agriculture, starting in the 70s, 80s. Today they are affecting us. Endocrine disruptors are major factors which alter the epigenome persistently. And in the field of epigenetic inheritance, actually that was the environmental factor which was the most studied, which has been the most studied and which was studied first indeed. And one of the pioneers is Michael Skinner in the US. And he showed that in rats, this can affect families across multiple generations. Mm-hmm. So endocrine disruptors, but the diet as well, you know, poor diet, high fat diet for Western countries, low protein diet for countries where nutrition is an issue. These can also have major consequences for health. Mm. Of course, I'm more interested in psychiatric disorders because I'm a neurobiologist. So naturally, stress and trauma is something we are working on. But we, however, have a global view and consider that it's not just trauma. It's really all these environmental pollutants in a way, whether emotional stress or through the diet or through endocrine disruptors or pesticides.
Mm. So I wanted to, I wanted to ask you a little bit about the research you do, and now we talked about what effects and what are possible reasons. You talked about diet now, we talked about trauma. If the research that comes out of epigenetics and, or not the research, but the results of the research, if society would be aware of these results and they would think about making decisions that include these results in the way they live together, which is a broad field, but what do you think? How could society integrate what your research and other people's research is showing about epigenetics? Like, what is the practical point of view or the practical adaptation, maybe? Application of these results in our daily life, maybe, in our societies?
I think there is a lot of information and education which is necessary. And one of the most direct applications, I would say, is that everyone be made aware of the fact that the behavior towards others, in particular for adults, towards children, that their behavior can be very important for that child and determine the health and the well-being and happiness of that child later in life. Mm. And we know, in our societies, it's not conflicts, it's not war, which is really a major problem. It's violence, it's abuse, physical abuse, sexual abuse. In the past 5 years since the Me Too movement, we've heard a lot about that. And this is something which is really embedded into the society, this abuse of women, of children, mostly by men. I wish that men would know about the consequences of their acts. It's something which is very embedded into the society. Mm. And there are behaviors which were accepted, not an issue, even in the men who were perpetrating these these behaviors, they did not even realize that you cannot do that. People, you don't owe people, and that this can really damage the victims of your abuse. If this could already be fixed, I think that would be a major, major progress.
Mm. So I read in your book that there's these passages like, we don't know yet, or we still have to find this out. And I think it's some years ago. So I wanted to ask you just as a last question, what are the questions you are working on now? Like, what are the fields that epigenetics are exploring? What are relevant? Maybe also new things that have been found out. And what do you see when you look into the future? Is this going to be a bigger topic? What would you say to that?
The new things I would say is the realization of the complexity of the epigenome and thus the complexity of epigenetic alterations. For a long time, people thought, it's one epigenetic factor, the modification of the DNA itself. But meanwhile, we realize that no, it's a lot more than this. Again, to come back to the analogy with the computer, the hardware is just one code. Mm. And in this respect, the genetic code is simple. It's one code. It's four letters, four bases, which are put next to each other and make this code. The epigenome is many times, hundreds, thousands of times more complex because there are many factors. And these factors, they work in combination. And these factors, we don't know yet which one are going to be modified by what, for how long, and which one of the alterations will stay in the adult, because that's very important. Let's say you have a child who eats fat, who eats badly, mm-hmm. junk food. And this may affect his body or her body for a couple of years. And then when this person starts feeding himself or herself normally, everything will disappear except some changes in liver, in pancreas, maybe in the brain will stay and maybe continue to have effects and give diabetes or cancer later in life. But we don't know exactly which one of these changes are important, which one will stay, and how much exposure to high-fat diet, to stress, to endocrine disruptors is necessary to induce these changes, those changes which will make a difference and have consequences in the adult. So all this is still being studied in animals. And another question is, how much of what we find in animals is translatable to humans? And something that I'm also very interested in is to understand how are these changes induced? What is the link between being stressed and having epigenetic changes in sperm cells, which may transfer these symptoms to the offspring? Mm. And this is a very difficult question because it's complex. You are exposed to stress. It's the brain which processes the stress, release of stress hormone, many other factors. How does this reach the germ cells? And in germ cells, what does it do? How can it lead to epigenetic changes which will be passed to the offspring? Mm. I think this will give us work for another couple of years.
Auf Spurensuche nach Natürlichkeit. Ein Blog von Bastian Barucker.
Liebe Zuhörer, sollte Ihnen dieser Podcast wertvoll erscheinen, freue ich mich über Spenden. Nur mit finanzieller Unterstützung kann ich weiterhin Veröffentlichungen ermöglichen. Herzlichen Dank.